Thank you very much. Good evening. Good evening.
Can I just start by asking you a very personal and human question? 47 years ago was when your father was toppled, when the forces of Ayatollah Khomeini came to power and declared on February 11th, 1979, the first Islamic Republic. Where were you at the time? What were you thinking? Did you think, as your father and mother and other siblings were leaving the country, that this was it forever, or what?
Well, I actually was in Lubbock, Texas, undergoing pilot training when the revolution happened. The plan was for me to return to Iran after a year of training and perhaps go to the military academy and continue my formation. My parents left Iran January 16th of 1979. So basically, that was the beginning of our forced exile, and I never got to return to Iran. And ever since, it's been an odyssey of exile. And when my father passed away in Egypt in the summer of 1980, I was practically engaged into the politics of Iran, opposition politics, that is, obviously, to the current regime. So it's been 47 years and counting now.
So clearly a lot of people in this room, a lot of certainly Western leaders, maybe others, they've always had a very, very rough relationship with the current government of Iran, with the Islamic Republic. And every time there is a protest, and there have been many, every time, they and the Iranian exiles essentially say, this is it. This is the time that it's going to happen. I remember being there in 2009 over a disputed election, and I was with the people as they were running in the streets saying, it's going to happen this time, it's going to happen this time. That was inside Iran. What do you think made this December, January protest different, bigger, more intense?
You know, for all of us who have been involved in the struggle for liberty and freedom against this regime, and as you pointed, there have been many upheavals and perhaps unsuccessful campaign in the sense that the regime is still standing. But the resolve and perseverance of Iranians have continued. In the latest uprising, which was, of course, the Women Life Freedom Movement, we saw to what extent Iranians from all walks of life, from the four corners of Iran, including, of course, the diaspora, were supporting that. But I think something that is definitely the game changer, if I could call it that, and by the same token, the frequency of these protests increased over the years. If they were separated the first time, I'm thinking about the first upheaval of students during the Khatami era, all the way through the Green Movement in 2009 and all the way to the last few years, we've seen that the repetition and frequency of these uprisings became more and more and shorter and shorter. And of course, this time, well beyond a protest because of economic circumstances, what have you, when people start chanting death to the dictator, that means they're fed up with the regime. They want political change. They want fundamental change. They no longer believe that by reform we can achieve that end, that this regime simply doesn't allow for any kind of process allowing for people to decide whether or not they reject the current government they have. So we are forced into revolt. And we started this revolt in the last few months. We saw how many people were chanting the slogans and came to the streets, only to be faced with a severe repression that led to, unfortunately, a genocide level reaction by the regime, shooting people on the street with military weaponry, chasing people in hospitals, finishing them up, shooting a final shot in their heads on their hospital beds. Women are currently being raped in prison. Soldiers are being arrested and executed for refusing to cooperate with the regime in the repressive of people. This is really something that is right under our eyes. There's a sea of blood that separates today Iranian people with this regime. So if you ask me whether this time the nation is fed up and ready to act, they are. What we do need, however, is an equalizing factor because we saw how the regime treated its own citizens. That's where I think a lot of Iranians inside and outside hope that an intervention that will neutralize the regime instrument of repression will finally give us an opportunity for a final.
And what does that look like? Is that intervention by the United States? Certainly, even now, I know people are saying inside Iran, certainly everybody outside Iran, that they are waiting for President Trump to actually deliver on what he said. Remember, he said, seize your institutions, help is on the way, etc. And it didn't happen.
Well, not yet. And I think the reason it hasn't is perhaps because, first of all, mobilizing for it is not an easy affair. We have to consider many aspects. But most importantly, I think President Trump realizes that he needs to convince the whole world that I've given a diplomatic solution or diplomatic effort the maximum chance. We have to see to what extent the Iranians are, from their side, are willing to settle for what is being asked. I don't see it very likely that they will actually come even close to what are the demands, which will then say, look, by diplomatic means, we haven't managed to get it done, so now we can move forward with that.
Are you yourself in touch with the senior American administration officials? Is there a sense that they are also in this with you, so to speak, that they also actually want to see regime change? Because, you know, the latest statement from President Trump after meeting with the Israeli prime minister just this week, he basically said, where are we here? He said there was nothing definitive reached in this meeting other than I insisted that negotiations with Iran continue to see whether or not a deal can be consummated. If it can, I let the Prime Minister know that will be my preference. So no talk about the people or regime change. How did you read that?
I think for what is obviously an attempt to say, let's try to resolve this diplomatically. But at the same time, I think President Trump realizes that the Iranian people have been very clear in their ask for support. They actually believed in his promise of help is near, hanging there. And that's a very important position to take. There's a lot at stake in terms of maintaining face vis-a-vis that expectation. But never mind my conversations with the U.S. administration or, for that matter, European politicians. The most important conversation I have is with the people of Iran. And I can tell you, from political prisoners to members of civil society to many Iranians that have been fighting the fight and have been dying on the streets, they are asking the world to intervene. We are asking for a humanitarian intervention to prevent more innocent lives being killed in the process. We need to have that support and have an equalized playing field so we have a real chance as unarmed citizens to overcome this repressive regime.
You know, again, a month ago you said you were very confident that this is it for the regime. You said the planets were aligned. But as we saw, which has happened over and over again, that they come out, there's a, you know, the government allows it for a minute, and then they crack down. And they did it again incredibly swiftly and brutally, as we've all been documenting this time. I want to ask you about what you said as well. You also called on people to come out, and you told them that there would be a 50,000, I'm picking that number that you used, you know, guard of defectors and people who would save them and protect them during their demonstrations. Of course, that didn't happen, and they were alone, and they were slaughtered. So why did you say that? What was it based on? And who are the people that you say are defecting? And if not then, when? When are we going to see that?
Well, look, there are many elements within the regime structure that refused to carry out the orders of repression, and they were severely penalized. We know of some police officers that were executed by the regime for refusing to crack down. We know of the fact that the regime had to import from Afghanistan, from Iraq, from Lebanon, elements that were not even Iranian citizens to do the dirty job. That to me is a sign of desperation, knowing that they were pushed back. They panicked, they shut down the internet, and in the darkest of night they did what they did. To a point that today you have the Chancellor of Germany saying that this regime has lost complete legitimacy. So maybe finally the changing factor would be shifting from a four-decade-long policy of appeasement of this regime towards we have to find a solution beyond this regime. Most importantly, because of the people calling that. Now, there has been defections already. We had a specific project as part of the entire movement to call for people who have to show and demonstrate the intentions to defect. Many have applied and many have reached. Many of them are members of the military and paramilitary forces. They are also members of the civil bureaucracy. Now, there's an extent to which they can do their part, but as long as the RGC and Khamenei are sitting up, they're using them as an instrument of repression. Even if you have defectors, it's not enough to be a shield of protection. People were chanting anyway on the streets, and we, in fact, were successful in pushing the regime back, except for the regime acted the way it did. So what do we do now? Do we have a temporary retreat? We are. But people are continuing the struggle. They're continuing to chant slogans. You see an unprecedented solidarity of Iranians in the four corners of the world, demonstrating their support for them. We've seen millions of people on the streets of Iran that are doing it. Does liberty have a price? Of course it does. Are we prepared to die for this cause? Of course we are. Our whole point is that we don't have a choice but to fight. We don't have a choice but to liberate ourselves. And the only way you can minimize the struggle in terms of time and loss of human life is not to be alone in this fight. There's too much blood between us and this regime. There's no turning back for us. So the question is the world this time going to be on the right side of history and support the Iranian people in their struggle for liberation? Or are we going to go back to business as usual and consider another movement that hasn't panned out? And I think a lot of it depends on the policy of straddling the fence and not committing to one side or the other. This is a choice to be made because the circumstances exist right now as we speak. There's an opportunity, there's a window that exists right now that could be the game changer for the whole world.
I can really hear you trying to call on something, and that something I think is intervention.
It is intervention only because the Iranian people realize that this intervention will eliminate the most important stumbling block between them and liberation, which is the regime's mechanism of repression and this killing machine. What does it mean? It means IRGC. It means any other instrument of repression. It means further economic sanctions. It means cutting economic, the regime's means to basically pay the checks of their mercenaries at the end of the day. It means putting more diplomatic pressure, expelling their diplomats, shutting down the embassy, repurposing the frozen assets that belong to the Iranian people to, in fact, help the Iranian people fund their campaign of labor strikes, help us with the internet and access to the world. And, you know, we had specific demands on that as to where the world can take steps that would be helpful to this campaign.
Okay, so I think it's important not to forget that 47 years ago, it was your family that was overthrown. It was your father that was overthrown. There was a reason for that. And I wonder how you, talk about that right now, how you think about that right now. And also, like it or not, Ayatollah Khomeini had a ground game. He had the mosques. He had people who are actually religious. And he had access to the press, as you know, in Paris. And he had a real operation, you know, cassettes smuggled in with his words into the mosques in Iran. I was there during that year of the revolution, and I remember it very well. So this is all to ask you, why do you think a Pahlavi should be the leader again? And how can you do it? What kind of a plan do you have? What kind of a political ground game inside the country do you have? I mean, it's necessary, right? You've got to also be able to convince people there and to have an organization.
Well, when it comes to the name, that's the name that people chanted on the streets of Iran by the millions in 31 provinces of Iran, in the four corners of Iran. They called my name. They asked me to come to their support, and I have. And I accepted the challenge of leading the transition. As far as the plan that we have a plan before the regime's collapse and particularly for the transition after this regime, which is very well documented and presented. It's an open document. You can see it on the website of the Iran Prosperity Project. It talks about the initial 100 days. How do we manage that process? How do we avoid what happened in Iraq post Saddam Hussein, because we don't want to have the same experience of de-Ba'athification. And one of the key components of this strategy is how much defection can exist, not just because we need them on the side of the people, but because, and that has been my principal position, that anyone who doesn't have their hands soiled with the blood of the Iranian people should survive regime change and have a place in the future. They can be part of the solution as opposed to remain part of the problem. That's very critical to maintain a stable transition, both on the civilian side as well as the military paramilitary side.
So I want to follow up on what you just said, whoever doesn't have blood on their hands. But as you know, a lot of your supporters or people claiming to be your supporters, or I don't know, bots online or whatever, have zero tolerance to anybody who's in Iran right now. They call everybody a collaborator, everybody an appeaser. There is this incredible woman, Narges Mohammadi, who's a Nobel Peace Laureate. She should be a source of pride for her human rights and her sacrifice that she's made. And yet, online, it is catastrophic what people claiming to be your supporters are saying. So I don't know whether you want to say something to them, whether you reject this kind of lumping together anybody who actually lives in Iran and has to survive.
Look, I've always spoken against any kind of political violence or intimidation as a matter of principle. And I think this is an opportunity to say that one of our asks is, of course, the immediate release of all political prisoners. That includes Narges Mohammadi. And I think when you look at the future of Iran, while today we can all be allies for a common cause of liberation and a secular democracy as an alternative to this clerical dictatorship, I think we are all in the same boat. We may vote differently tomorrow, and tomorrow someone like Narges Mohammadi may choose to run as prime minister or president. That's fine. But today we need to first address the issue of liberation. And on that, I think the vast majority of Iranian secular Democrats, whether they are Republicans or monarchists or socialists or conservative or, you know, representative of our ethnic groups or religious minorities, when you look at the diversity among us, we are quite united on these principles. And I think that is where we need to stand together in unison and do not allow those who, and I think the regime is behind a lot of these campaigns, to try to discredit not just me, but pose as representative of this or that group, because they always try to play the divide and rule game. They always tried over the years to make sure that such an array of opposition can never unite in a real sense. What I call, again, and I take the opportunity to remind people what this struggle is all about. This struggle is about freedom. This struggle is about the equality of all citizens. This struggle is about freedom of speech. This struggle is all about democracy and the ballot box. And we can certainly compete in the future, but today is the time to make sure that we don't have that ballot box through which we can determine who has what level of support or who can be able to do this and that. We need to get there first. So remind ourselves, we're reminding everybody, our cause is for everyone to fit under this tent. And this tent could be as wide as it can get, so long as we can agree on at least, this is what I'm calling for, on at least four key principles. Number one is Iran's territorial integrity. This is a matter very important for many Iranians. Yep. Number two is the obvious need for separation of church from state, which is a prerequisite to democracy. On that we agree, including many clerics in Iran who have spoken time and again against the Velayat-e Faqih. They don't believe that religion has a place in politics, and they know how much damage was done to the faith as a result of this.
So just we know that is the guiding principle of the Islamic Republic. The supreme leader represents
God. And we had many clerics from the beginning who were ostracized by the regime. Today we have one of the leading clerics in Iran, Molavi Abdul Hamid, a Sunni cleric who has spoken against his regime and believes, in fact, as a clergyman, in the separation of church from state. So it's an established fact within the Iranian people. Number three is equality of all citizens under the law and individual liberties. And number four is the right for the Iranian people to determine their own future, which is exactly the agenda of the transitional government, to make sure that Iran will be, Iranians will have the ability to elect their representative to the Constitutional Assembly, to decide first what it is that they want in their future. And unlike 1979, where nobody had a clue what Islamic Republic means, but a clear option as to what are the diverse possibilities, allow for a constitutional assembly to draft a constitution, allow for people to either adopt it by a referendum or reject it and have another draft, all for it to finally end up with a ratified constitution approved by the nation. Then we will have the elections of the first parliament and the first government of that future democracy. Whether it ends up being a republic or it ends up being a constitutional monarchy, that's exactly for the people to decide. And the minute this happens, the transitional government dissolves itself and turn over control to the elected members of the Iranian parliament and government. That's the end of that process of transition.
I'm going
from
to get
now
you
until the next future
to your future
democracy.
Role. But I really do need to ask you, will you tell your supporters online or wherever they might be to stop, in your name, this kind of attack on ordinary Iranians, because it's very terrifying?
I have, and they know it, and it's not only them. I think this should be for everyone to follow as a principle. There shouldn't be any place for political violence or intimidation from anyone. And I think we should all adhere to principles I'm not talking just one group. I'm talking to every single Iranian out there, regardless of their political affiliation. We need to show and demonstrate that exactly that's where we differ. A regime that is, in a punitive way, forcing an ideology and has been discriminating against every possible aspect of people disagreeing with them, as opposed to those of us who cherish the values of freedom, have tolerance for other viewpoints, believe in pluralism, and that's exactly how we define ourselves as a contrast to this regime. We have to show it beyond words in action. And that's something that I've always called for. But I cannot control millions of people and whatever they say in social media, and who knows if they're real people or not. That I can't control. But I can only stress the importance of
these values. You don't approve
of it? Of course I don't approve. And I've condemned it. I think there are many people in this room who, in fact, often have reposted my statements that are aware of this fact, that I've done my part as much as possible to condemn that type of behavior that I will not tolerate and will not stand for.
To your role, what do you want to represent if there was this opportunity? Do you want to be king? Do you want to be president? What is your role in this situation?
You know, from the first day I started, I considered my mission in life to bring the country to a point that we can have that final referendum and the people elect their first democratic government in the future. That, to me, is the finish line and mission accomplished in life. I don't have any personal ambition. I'm not seeking power. I don't want to have a crown on my head or a title, but I think that they should look at me as a bridge to that destination and not the destination itself. That's my focus. And any other argument about whether or not I will have a future role is placing the cart before the horse. My focus is on delivering on what I promised 47 years ago. That has been my commitment. And the reason millions of people in Iran are calling me and my name and want my return is because they know that they can't trust me on this. I'm the only person that was not part of the revolution or ever associated with this regime. And that's a big plus when it comes to how many candidates are out there. And that's why you hear my name chanted on the streets of Iran, and a lot of people in the diaspora supports it as well.
I remember covering the Ahmadinejad era in Iran, and it was a very aggressive posture on every issue, including anti-Semitism, anti-Israel, talking about wiping it off the face of the map. Very, very violent. And I think it really, really put certainly the Israelis and Jews around the world off. You have been to Israel. You have, I believe, visited the Western Wall. You are supported by this Israeli government. I want to know what you think and why you think that's important, because equally this Israeli government has shown itself to be incredibly intolerant of its own citizens' rights, its Muslim citizens' rights inside Israel and of course in Gaza, the occupied West Bank, and it's very controversial. So I just wondered why you think that is an important relationship to build?
Well, first I would say that I think there are only two nations on this planet that can claim they have a biblical relationship with one another. One is Israel, one is Iran. And it goes back to the time of Cyrus the Great. Cyrus the Great, who liberated the Jewish slaves in Babylon and helped them rebuild their temple in Jerusalem. And when Iranians go and gather at Pasargad around Cyrus the Great's tomb years ago, of all walks of life, of different ethnicities, different religions, and celebrate Cyrus the Great because he represents the every values that Iranians cherish and believe in, and say that we are not a nation at war with our neighbors. We can be trusted partners in the region, working with the Arab countries, working with Israel, as opposed to a regime that is acting the way it did. That's the difference right there. We need to be able to show the world that Iranians, unlike this regime, are committed to friendly relationship with our neighbors. We don't have any issue with the Arabs. We don't have any issue with the Israelis. And why is Israel important? Because I think it is a very important strategic partner to Iran when it comes to this. I'm thinking beyond just the politics of it. I'm talking about the water crisis in Iran, which is a major issue for us. Well beyond politics. If there's no water, there's no life. And guess who have the best specialists and experts in the world dealing with water issues? Israeli experts. One of the reasons I went to Israel was to talk about that as well. And there's so many ways that we can engage and partner with them, helping us in that area. As opposed to a regime that says, no, they don't even have the right to exist. That's the difference. So it's not necessarily focusing only on one country. It's a regional thing, but most importantly, from the prism, whether it's Europe or the United States, Why can't we, as people of that region, be the ones working together to bring about stability without having to depend on an armada of U.S. Aircraft carriers to maintain stability and peace in the region? Why can't we work with our with each other? That's the difference, because Iranians are committed to that. And when you look at how it's perceived inside Iran, let's remember one thing. The regime has been the one financing its proxies, Hezbollah, Hamas. When they got over $200 billion a few years ago, that was spent not on, you know, Iranians that are starving on the streets, but to, in fact, empower these proxies that led perhaps to October 7th. And when people for years have been chanting in Iran, neither Gaza nor Lebanon, my life will be sacrificed for Iran, that means what? That means not Hamas, not Hezbollah. And in that sense, it's a very clear demarcation from this regime. This is not me saying it. This is people chanting it for years to come. Before the mass uprising, after the mass uprising. That's part of the national psyche. Today, in every demonstration we see in the diaspora, you see that it's the Iranian national flag. A lot of time we see the Israeli flag and the respective flag of the country where they live. Tomorrow in the rally, you'll probably see a lot of German flags, as we saw Australian flag in Australia, as we saw the Canadian flag in Toronto and Montreal, or the American flag in LA, showing that Iranians are respective universally of any peace-loving nations. They are respective of their host country. That's the difference between us and this regime that basically so antagonistic. I think that's basically the spirit of our movement that is demonstrated by the will and resolve of Iranians that say, we are not this regime. We are not warmongers. We want to be the peacemakers.
There is so much we could talk more about. This is a very good table laying of your plans and your, you know, your proposals. I just want to open to one person on the floor, because you remember after the Women Life Freedom protests, there was the Georgetown Coalition, which saw you on stage uniting with a lot of diaspora activists, including Nazanin Bunyadi and Masih Ali Najjar. I think they're both here, but we're going to ask Nazanin to stand up. And of course, that didn't last. It didn't last. It was just a very brief moment of unity. And I don't know whether Nazanin wants to say anything on behalf of, you know, opposition.
Oh, well, thank you so much for the important conversation, Shahzad. It's good to see you. As you reiterated today, you have consistently affirmed your commitment to democracy, to specifically a tolerant secular democracy. A lot of Iranians look to you because of your commitment to this over decades, and particularly because of your commitment to building institutional democracy and cultural democracy, really democracy that is covers all of culture in Iran. And the truth is that the brutality of the regime has caused deep wounds. And Iranians are rightfully filled with disdain, and many seek vengeance even. But history has shown us that any kind of revolution fueled by anger often results in the same injustices that we're trying to break away from. My question to you is, how do we collectively channel that anger so that we're building democratic institutions and reconciliation, and focusing on the rule of law, and really focusing not only on bringing down tyranny, but creating liberty?
Thank you.
Well, we had so many conversations, you and I, over the years, and I salute your commitment, where you had to step in away from your career and engage with advocacy for human rights, and your speech at the UN and other venues. Exactly. We need to show that there's a culture that is needed there. The instruments of democracy are not alone by themselves, even if you have the best constitution. If culturally we don't adopt pluralism and tolerance as part of our behavior, and civility should be the way to go as opposed to revenge and settling of accounts, of course we need to encourage that. You know how many times I've explained my call for ultimately national reconciliation. How many times we spoke about amnesty. But we cannot deny the Iranian people their day in court. Grieving mothers, martyrs, people who have died by this repression. We cannot escape the need for justice, which is why a lot of the efforts is led by people who are experts in the field. We have many lawyers that are working on that, fact-finding about what happened, truth and reconciliation, transitional justice, because all of this plays into giving people closure without having to resort to vengeance. That's very important. So the more we equip our society, and a lot of it is civil society's role, a lot of it has to be with our activists, with our experts, I think it could help us institutionalize and have the instances that protects us as a society, as a nation, from all the possible deviation. We need to adopt all possible processes that have proven to be successful in such transition that happen in other countries, post-collapse of very totalitarian and ruthless regimes, whether it was South Africa, whether it was the Soviet Union, or many other instances. There are so many models to implement or emulate. But most importantly is to make sure that we, in fact, show how different we are than this regime. Because if we start acting like them, then what's the difference? And I'm glad to have people such as yourself helping out in this. And we need to encourage more people to weigh in. Look, a lot of us have lived in free societies for the past 4 decades, at least I have. And there are a lot of people inside Iran who were not even born at the time of the revolution. Today's Gen Z in Iran is very much on par with this. In fact, most of what I hear from inside Iran is that there may be some issues that you hear outside that we're not even concerned with. We are all very united, but we need help. We need to make sure that we are not alone in this, that there is a reinforcement factor. That's where people who are wise enough to understand that we have to materially and structurally help the nation have to understand that before we agree on disagreeing, we have to agree on what we all are in common in need of. So it's really a national challenge, if you will. I think this national challenge transcends political affiliation, transcends particular, tendencies. It doesn't matter if you're socialist or conservative. It shouldn't matter if you're a Republican or a monarchist. It should matter that we all believe in democracy at the end and the rule of law and the protection under that law. That's the way we will put an end to discrimination, whether it's against women, ethnic groups, religious minorities, and everything else between. I believe we can do that because we have learned it the hard way to appreciate these values. And we have today this opportunity to do it. Okay. So I'm encouraging activists. I'm encouraging journalists. I'm encouraging our political prisoners. I'm encouraging our civil society. And those of us who have more freedom to speak where people inside don't have the first job of making sure that we are their voice and we support them. That's how it starts, and hopefully we'll end it in Iran itself.
All right. Reza Pahlavi, thank you very much indeed. Now we are going to, please feel free. Now we're going to thank you very much. Thank